stroked Mahmoud's hair and shook her head. "No, my beautiful boy. If the boat hadn't come along when it did, if you hadn't convinced them to take her, she would have drowned. I couldn't keep us above water. You saved her. I know you did. She's out there somewhere. We just have to find her." Mahmoud nodded into his mother's shoulder. "I'll find her again, Mom. I promise." Mahmoud and his mother cried and held each other until Mahmoud remembered they weren't getting any closer to Hana or to Germany. He dragged a sleeve across his wet mouth and nose, and his mother kissed him on the forehead. "That thief took us about halfway to Hungary, at least," Mahmoud's father said, looking at his phone. "We're on a back road, about an hour's drive from the border. I think we're close to a bus stop. It means we have to walk again, though." Mahmoud helped his mother stand, and his father hefted Walid up higher on his shoulder. Mahmoud's little brother had slept through the whole thing. Mahmoud worried again about his brother. Air raids, shootouts, taxi holdups, nothing seemed to faze him anymore. Was he just keeping all his tears and screams pent up inside, or was he becoming so used to horrible things happening all around him that he didn't notice anymore, didn't care? Would he come to life again when they got to Germany? If they got to Germany? They made it to the bus stop in time to catch the late bus to Horgos, a Serbian city on the Hungarian border. Even more Syrian refugees had collected there, but no one was getting through, not by road or rail, or even out in the countryside, the way Mahmoud and his family had crossed into Macedonia and Serbia. The Hungarians had a fence. It wasn't finished yet, but even now, at night, Hungarian soldiers were hard at work, driving 4-meter-tall metal poles into the ground along the border and stretching chain-link fencing between them. Once the fence was hung, another group came behind them and attached 3 tiers of razor-wire coil to it to keep people from climbing over. The Hungarians were closing their border.
"But we don't even want to go to Hungary," Mahmoud said. "We just want to get through to Austria."
"The Hungarians don't care, I guess," Dad said. "They don't want us in their country, whether we're coming or going." A group of refugees suddenly rushed a part of the unfinished fence, trying to get through before it was done.
"We're not terrorists," someone cried. "We're refugees." "We just want to get through to Germany. They'll take us," someone else cried.
There were more shouts and screams, and before Mahmoud knew what was happening, he and his family were caught up in the press of refugees trying to get across the border. Mahmoud was jostled from every side. He clung to the back of his father's shirt, hanging on like Dad was a life preserver and they were going over a waterfall. As frightening as the stampede was, Mahmoud was excited too. The refugees were finally doing something. They weren't just disappearing into their tent cities. They were standing up and saying, "Here we are! Look at us! Help us!" But the Hungarian soldiers weren't interested in helping. As the refugees swarmed the border, soldiers in blue uniforms with red berets and red armbands hurried to stop them, firing tear gas canisters into the crowd. One of the canisters exploded near Mahmoud with a bang, and people screamed as a gray-white cloud erupted around them. Mahmoud's eyes burned like someone had sprayed hot pepper juice in them, and mucus poured from his nose. He choked on the gas, and his lungs seized up. He couldn't breathe. It was like he was drowning on land. He fell to his knees, clutching at his chest and gasping uselessly for air. "I'm going to die," Mahmoud thought. "I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die."
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 22 days from home. Joseph watched his sister splashing around happily in the swimming pool on A deck. Other kids chased each other around the promenade, watched movies, played shuffleboard. For as much as he'd wanted to grow up, Joseph wished now that he could join them. Be a little kid again, cheerfully oblivious to what was going on around him. But he wasn't a kid anymore. He had responsibilities, like keeping his sister and his mother safe. Papa had told him what the concentration camps were like. He couldn't let that happen to Ruthie and his mother. "Are you ready?" It was Posner. He stood in the shadow of a smokestack, looking around nervously. Joseph nodded. He had agreed to help take over the ship. He had to do something, and this was the only thing he could do. "What about Shindik and his firemen?" Joseph asked as they walked. "We've got a distraction for them down on D-deck, but we have to move fast." The rest of the group came together near the social hall. There were 10 men, including Joseph, and they all carried metal candlesticks and pieces of pipe. Some of the men were Papa's age, like Posner, and some of them were in their 20s. Joseph was by far the youngest. 10 men, Joseph thought. A minion. 10 Jews come together not to worship, but to mutiny. Posner put a small length of lead pipe in Joseph's hand, and suddenly the weight of what Joseph was about to do was very real. "Lead on," Posner said. Joseph took a deep breath. There was no turning back now. He led his fellow mutineers into the maze of crew corridors. Just outside the bridge, in the chart room where all the maps were stored, they came across Ostermeyer, the first officer. He looked up from the map cabinet with surprise, but before he could do anything, Posner and one of the other men grabbed him and pushed him through the door to the bridge. Joseph was startled by how rough they were being with Ostermeyer, but he tried to swallow his fear. Taking over the ship wasn't going to be easy, and this was only the start. There weren't as many people on the bridge as there had been when Joseph visited, just one officer and 3 sailors. The sailor at the ship's helm saw them first, and he let go of the steering wheel to dive for an alarm. One of the passengers got to him first, slamming into the helmsman and sending him tumbling to the floor. The mutineers quickly surrounded the other sailors, threatening them with their makeshift clubs. And they had done it. Just like that, they had taken the bridge. Joseph's heart raced as he looked around, wondering what was next. Stretched out before them was the great green-blue Atlantic Ocean, and beyond that, still days away, Germany and the Nazis. Up on the little platform at the back of the room, the steering wheel teetered back and forth, and Joseph wondered crazily if he should jump up there and turn the ship around himself. "Send for the captain," Posner told the first officer. Warily, Ostermeyer went to the ship's intercom and summoned Captain Schroeder to the bridge. As soon as Captain Schroeder stepped onto the bridge, he understood what was happening. He spun to leave, but Joseph and one of the other men blocked his exit.
"Who's in charge here?" Captain Schroeder asked. "What do you mean by all this?"
Posner stepped forward.
"We mean to save our lives by taking over the ship," he said, "and sailing it to any other country but Germany."
Captain Schroeder put his hands behind his back and walked to the middle of the bridge. He looked out at the ocean, not Posner.
"The other passengers will not support you, and my crew will overpower you," he said matter-of-factly. "All you are doing is laying yourselves open to a charge of piracy."
Posner and the others looked around at each other nervously. Joseph couldn't believe they were so easily losing their resolve.
"We'll hold you here as hostages," Joseph said. "They'll have to do as we say."
Even Joseph was surprised he'd spoken up, but his words seemed to put a little more steel back in the mutineers' resolve. Captain Schroeder turned to look at Joseph.
"The crew will obey only me," he said calmly, "and I will give no order, no matter what you do, that will take my ship off its set course. And without that order, you can do nothing. What will you do? Pilot the ship yourself?"
Joseph blushed and stared at the ground, remembering his crazy urge to take the wheel when he didn't even know how it worked or where to go. Captain Schroeder helped his fallen helmsman back to his feet and led him to the steering wheel. The man was still shaking from the attack, but he took the helm and straightened the ship on course.
"You have done enough already for me to prefer serious charges against you," Captain Schroeder said, still frustratingly even-keeled. "If I do, I can assure you that you will most certainly be taken back to Germany, and you know what that means."
Joseph steamed. He did know what that meant,
But did Captain Schroeder know? Really know? How many Germans really understood what was happening in the concentration camps? Joseph knew because his papa had told him, had shown him when he jumped overboard and tried to kill himself. Joseph wasn't about to let his mother and sister end up in one of those camps.
"You would do that to us?" one of the men asked the captain. "You are doing it to yourselves," Schroeder said. "Listen, I understand and sympathize with your desperation."
Posner huffed.
"You have no idea what we've been through, any of us."
Captain Schroeder nodded. "No, you're right. But no matter what's been done to you, what you're doing now is a real criminal act. By law, I should have you all thrown in the brig. But I'm willing to overlook all this if you leave the bridge right now and give me your word you will take no such further action."
Joseph scanned the faces of his co-conspirators and saw only panic, fear, surrender.
"No," Joseph told them. "No," he told Captain Schroeder. "My father told me what happened to him in those camps. I can't let that happen to my mother and my little sister. We can't go back to Germany."
The first officer took that moment to try to pull free from the men holding him. There was a struggle. The other sailors moved to help him, and the other mutineers flinched, ready to fight.
"Ostermeyer, no," Captain Schroeder commanded. "Cease and desist. That's an order."
The first officer froze, and Posner froze too, the lead pipe in his hand still raised in threat. Nobody moved. The captain raised his hands.
"I promise you, men," he said quietly, his voice almost a whisper. "I promise you on my honor as a sea captain that I will do everything possible to land you in England. I will run the ship aground there if I must. But you must stand down and promise me no further trouble."
Posner lowered his pipe.
"Agreed," he said. "No, no," Joseph wanted to argue, but everyone else agreed.
Joseph threw his pipe to the ground and left without the other men.
They were going back to Europe, and there was nothing he could do about it.
Isabel, off the coast of Florida, 1994, 5 days from home. They were going back to Cuba, and there was nothing any of them could do about it. So this was the last verse, Isabel thought. After everything they'd been through, after everything they'd lost, their climactic ending wasn't going to be climactic after all. Theirs wasn't a Son Cubano, with its triumphant finale. Theirs was a fugue, a musical theme that was repeated again and again without resolution. Their coda was to be forever homeless, even when returned to their own home. Forever refugees in their own land. The U.S. Coast Guard had found them.
"Geraldo,"
Isabel's mother said. But Papi didn't answer. He sat frozen with all the others as a bright white searchlight clicked on. A ship motor, a real motor, attached to a real propeller, roared to life.
"Geraldo,"
Mommy said again.
"It started."
"No," he said. "It's over. For all of us. They're going to take us to Guantanamo."
The searchlight swung around toward them.
"No,"
Mommy said, hands on her bulging stomach, her voice tinged with alarm.
"No, I mean, it started. The baby's coming."
The head of every single person in the little boat turned in surprise. Isabel sat down with a splash in the water. She didn't know what to think, how to feel. She'd been put through the ringer. The elation of leaving Cuba, the exhaustion of the storm, the horror of Ivan's death, the relief at seeing the lights of Miami, the despair of running into the Coast Guard ship and knowing they would never get to El Norte. And now, her mother was having a baby. Isabel's baby brother. Isabel could only sit lifelessly and stare. She had nothing left to give.
"I'm not staying in that refugee camp at Guantanamo, behind a barbed wire fence," Lito said. "That's just trading one prison for another. I'll go back to Cuba. back to my home. Castro said he won't punish anyone who tried to leave.
Unless he's changed his mind again, Amara said. It was Luis who saw the Coast Guard searchlight sweep past them on the water and point somewhere else.
Maybe none of us will have to go to Guantanamo, Luis said. Look, they're not after us. The Coast Guard is after someone else.
Isabel watched as the searchlight found another craft on the water a few hundred meters away. It was a raft full of refugees, just like them.
More Cubans?
Amara asked.
It doesn't matter, Señor Castillo said. Now's our chance. Paddle for shore. Quickly.
Isabel spared her mother a look, then grabbed a water jug carved into a scoop and started rowing as hard as she could. So did Lito, Amara, and the Castillos.
But be quiet, Lito whispered. Sound carries a long way on the water.
Oh!
Isabel's mother cried.
Shh, Teresa,
Papi said, holding her hand.
Don't have the baby yet. Wait until we get to Florida.
Isabel's mother gritted her teeth and nodded, tears welling in her eyes. The lights of Miami got closer, but they were still so far away. Isabel glanced behind her. In the darkness, she could pick out the lights of the Coast Guard ship alongside another dark craft. Shadowy figures were moving back and forth between the two. They were taking the refugees on board to send them back to Cuba.
Oh!
Isabel's mother cried, her voice like a cannon shot in the quiet.
Row! Row!
Señor Castillo whispered. They were so close. Isabel could see which hotel rooms had their lights on and which were off, could hear bongos beating out a rhythm over the water, a rumba.
The current's taking us north, Luis whispered. We're going to miss it. It doesn't matter. As long as we're standing on land, we're safe,
Lito said, his voice thin from exertion.
We just can't be caught on the water. Row!
Oh!
Isabel's mother screamed, her voice booming out across the water.
Weep, weep!
The Coast Guard cutter made the same sound as before, and its searchlight lit up their little boat. They'd found them.
No!
Isabel's mother sobbed.
No, I want to have my baby in El Norte!
Row!
Señor Castillo yelled, giving up entirely on being quiet. Behind them, the Coast Guard cutter's motor roared to life. Isabel churned at the water, bending her flimsy jug paddle in her desperation. Tears streamed down her face. From sorrow, or fear, or exhaustion, she didn't know. All she knew was that they were still too far from shore. The Coast Guard ship was going to catch them before they reached Miami.
Mahmoud, Hungary, 2015. 16 days from home. Sirens. Soldiers shouting through bullhorns. Screams. Explosions. Mahmoud was barely aware of everything that was happening around him. He lay on the ground, curled into a ball, trying desperately to draw a breath that would not come. His eyes felt like bees had stung them, and his nose was a streaming cauldron of burning chemicals. He made a choking, gurgling sound that was somewhere between a shriek and a whimper. After everything, he was going to die here, on the border between Serbia and Hungary. Rough hands pulled Mahmoud from the ground and dragged him away, his sneakers twisting and scraping on the dirt road. He still couldn't see a thing, couldn't force his eyes to open, but he felt his chest beginning to work again, the barest tendrils of air reaching his lungs. He drank the air in greedily. Then he was thrown to the ground, and someone pulled his hands behind him and tied them together with a thin piece of plastic. It cinched painfully tight, and Mahmoud was lifted again and rolled onto the flat metal bed of a truck. He lay there, still gasping for breath, the plastic zip tie cutting angrily into his wrists
as more people were tossed